We're going to call the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Subcommittee on Gaming to order. We do not yet have a quorum, but we called this meeting to get a general overview of gaming and gambling issues in the state. We have several presenters here that are going to try to let us know what we might expect in terms of a legislative agenda for this year, what issues we need to be looking for, what we can be expecting, and we'll open it up for questions at the end of each presentation. We have Tom Barrett from the Gambling Control Board and Clint Harris from the Minnesota State Lottery and Richard Kruger from the Minnesota Racing Commission here to present today. So welcome, everybody. And with no further ado, we'll get started with Tom Barrett from the Gambling Control Board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the Executive Director of the Gambling Control Board. Appreciate the opportunity to come before the new subcommittee. Welcome, Senator. Included, I believe, in your packets today, we have a special report. It's known as the financial summary. And what it is a summary of all the charitable organizations that we currently license with the Gambling Control Board. And it shows a brief recap from their gross receipts, their expenses, their charitable contributions, all in summary form. But we first initiated that report last year, got a very favorable review. It's a very important document for not only regulatory oversight, but also the organizations as well. So I include that. Later this week, we hope to finalize the board's annual report, and we'll be getting a copy of that to each one of the board members. But that's the annual summary of activity in general, as well as some of the activity that's been going on at the local level. With that, I'd hope to go through relatively quickly a brief overview of what the Gambling Control Board does, how we regulate things, and what the picture is in Minnesota.
I'd like to announce that a quorum has been established.
Thank you. The board mission is twofold. One, to assure that the citizens that the games that are out there in charitable gambling have the integrity, that they're run correctly, and also that the nonprofit organizations can raise funds for ultimately charitable purposes. What is lawful gambling, otherwise known as charitable gambling? There's five forms. Pull tabs, by far and away the bread and butter of the charitable gambling industry. There's bingo, paddle wheels, tip boards, and raffles. And I'll stop right here and focus on paddle wheels real quick. I had a question a few years ago from a legislator asking if that was the boat-type paddle wheel that's on the river. No, it's similar to what you might see on the Wheel of Fortune, that kind of paddle wheel. Other gambling that we do not regulate, and it's really no secret, the lottery, and you'll be hearing shortly from Clint on what the lottery does. Tribal casinos comes under the jurisdiction of the public safety. Horse racing and the card club is under the Racing Commission, and you'll be hearing from those folks later on. And then there's also the illegal element related to gambling, whether it's the internet or sports boards, and it also is under the watchful eye of the Department of Public Safety, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement. We at the Gambling Control Board do work very closely with the other entities, but specifically with the Department of Public Safety, especially when one of our investigators might find something of criminal nature, criminal activity, then we bring those folks in to assist with the investigation and the prosecution. Who regulates lawful gambling? It's a seven-member citizens board. Five are appointed by the governor, one is appointed by the attorney general, and one is appointed by the commissioner of public safety. My staff, we have approximately 32 full-time equivalent, and they're split up under the licensing compliance, which is pretty much the auditors. They're inspecting the books. We have a small staff of investigators and then a very small staff related to administration. But structure-wise, it's split up those four ways. How do we regulate? There's a couple of ways that we do it. First of all, by licensing. We license anybody that's touching the product. We pretty much have to come through our doors. That includes the nonprofit organizations, the gambling managers, the manufacturers produce the product, the distributors that deliver the product, and something relatively new, linked bingo vendors. There's two currently licensed to conduct that activity. We also do it through education and training, primarily focusing on the gambling manager that's responsible for each organization. We also approve and test the games before they hit the street. Now, last year, on average, we had about 340 new games per month, or just over 4,000 games come through the Gambling Control Board for testing. You get a flavor of the volume and just by way of the games that we approve and we test. There's also regulatory audits and site inspections. That's going in literally to check the books and see how they've been spending the money. And if by those earlier measures we still have, if they don't work, then there are the opportunity to find suspensions, revocations. The industry that we regulate, relatively large in scope. There's over 3,300 current sites around the state of Minnesota conducting charitable gambling. 1,400 organizations, and for each organization there needs to be a gambling manager. Last year we issued over 2,400 exempt permits. These are small, relatively small, gambling permits to nonprofit organizations that don't have a full license. This might be a special church function or a civic event. In our database, we're reflecting about 13,000 paid employees. We suspect that might be a little on the high side in light of, you know, when there's turnover going on, but we're tracking that many employees nonetheless. Like I had mentioned, we have two Link Bingo vendors. We have 14 distributors located throughout Minnesota that are delivering the product, selling the product to the organizations. And then there's also 10 licensed manufacturers. Unfortunately, there's only one currently licensed within the boundaries of Minnesota. Some more charitable gambling numbers. $1.3 billion in gross receipts in fiscal year 06. I think, and that news really to anybody, Minnesota ranks number one in the nation when it comes to charitable gambling. Following in that, over $51 million was paid to the state in the way of tax receipts. And again, Minnesota ranks number one in that respect. When it comes to our regulatory budget, we're in at roughly $2.6 million. And in comparison to the other states, Minnesota actually ranks as one of the lowest in terms of regulation. But we do have a good thing here in terms of trying to monitor the industry that we're monitoring, and so far so good. Of the five forms, where do they play? Well, by far and away, the pull tabs makes up roughly 93% of the total gross sales. Bingo, next biggest, only 5%, but when you look at only $64 million, it's significant in that sense. And then followed by raffles, paddle wheels, and tip boards. As a comparison, because what we always hear when the Powerball jackpot, and this is with all due respect to our counterparts at the lottery, but when you hear about the Powerball jackpots, the millions, and it's on TV, it's a good thing for Minnesota, a good thing for the state. And I believe they had a record year last year in terms of sales at $450 million. And as you can see by this chart, charitable gambling in Minnesota on a down year is still roughly three times the size in terms of gross sales. So big activity that happens within our borders. Where does the money go? In terms of charitable gambling, 81% of the money goes back to the players in the way of prizes. Taxes, as you saw earlier, that's approximately 4%. Charitable makes up roughly $65 million in donations last year. There's expenses of $123 million, and then our fees and our budget is about 2.6. Another graphic illustration, if you will, but a lot of times we try to compare where does the money go and how is it split out. So if you take a typical $1 paid for a pull tab and every penny represents the going towards the cost of that, our regulatory efforts for our budget represents 1/5 of one of those pennies. So it's not real big in terms of the scope of the industry we're regulating. What are some of the issues and concerns? And you'll be hearing more about that as the session goes on. I'll talk briefly about the staffing ratios, expense limits for the charities. That's one of the hot buttons issues this session, pretty much following on the impact of what we're seeing going on with the smoking ban. I'll give you the short version of the year in review, but it's good information nonetheless. And then also some of the things that we're looking ahead legislatively as well as operations with the Gambling Control Board. Quickly, our staffing ratios, we did get an increase 2 years ago for staff. We were able to hire three additional staff, and that's been helpful. But we're still clipping along at roughly one investigator for every 1,300 sites. And I kind of compare when we have a game warden. If you know game warden, there's only going to be one on 1,300 lakes. You know, would you keep that extra walleye, or would you might not report all the cash? And so that's an ongoing concern we have, but we're managing. One of our best referrals are folks that we'll turn somebody in, it happens to be ex-spouses. Don't ask me why, but we get calls from ex-spouses, and that leads us to additional investigations. We have one compliance specialist. This is the auditors, and each one is assigned a geographic location, but it roughly averages out to about nearly 200 sites, 83 organizations. And what our goal is, and we're not there yet, but we're getting there, is to audit these organizations at least once every 2 years. With the additional staff that we got last couple of years, we've actually been able to improve those numbers, and that's a good thing. And then we also have a licensing specialist that, like I said, at the front door, if they want to get a permit, but they're dealing with roughly 3,100 permits and licenses on average per year. The expense limits for the charities are a concern, and some of the report detail, you'll see that. But under current law, charities may not spend more than 60% of their net profits for expenses. If by chance they're also running a bingo operation, they're allowed to go up, related to bingo, up to 70%. But what we're seeing is roughly 23% of those of the charities are currently exceeding that expense limit, and that equates to about 300 charities. The penalties for exceeding those limits, I would say, has been minimal. There is the opportunity before the board to bring some fines or sanctions against those, but they've been minimal. And so that is one of the legislative initiatives that we're looking to incorporate this year, is try to find ways not to hurt them if we can, but to get their attention. We have gotten their attention as relates to expenses, but there's still some folks and some issues that are going on that are causing a problem as it relates to expenses. And like I said, we'll probably be proposing a change related to the expense calculation for the charities. The impact from a smoking ban, let me say up front, though, that the board is neutral on the policy. We have no say in that whatsoever. But we have been tracking the impact for those areas, cities, counties that have enacted a smoking ban and what it's done as it relates to the charitable gambling side. So we have been tracking the impact. There's been some reports that have been released knowing that we've been tracking. But there are some interesting numbers to point out, and I only point it out just for information purposes. But it's an issue that obviously everybody's well aware of, and it's one that I think will be discussed at the Capitol. But currently, statewide gross receipts for lawful gambling are down 5% statewide. When you look at the areas that are affected by a smoking ban, the decrease in gross receipts go anywhere from 14 to 100%, depending upon what site. Locally here in St. Paul, where they went with a modified ban and then went to a full ban, at the end of this month, I believe they're going to close the last bingo hall just simply because the activity isn't there anymore, that the players aren't showing up. So there is an impact. Comparatively, the exempt sites, and this is where we're talking over in Hennepin County, where originally Hennepin County had a complete ban, and then reversed to what I would call a modified ban based on their sales of food and liquor. And so those sites that were able to qualify under the exempt ban and got the approval, we saw those sites actually are up by roughly 9%. Now, anything scientific? No, I'm not trying to do that. But we think there's a correlation happening related to charitable gambling at those locations with the smoking ban. Quickly, the year in review. As I had mentioned, our site inspections are up, and that's a good thing. People, the charitable organizations, like to see us out there. Not always, but for the majority of the time, they want to see the regulators make sure that they have things in line and everything is good. We've done something new this year, what we're calling our sweeps week, but we've coordinated some of our efforts along with the Department of Revenue and the Department of Public Safety. And what's been happening is we'll target a geographic area and then cooperatively go to those areas and do a complete sweep of the town or a couple of the towns. And we're going into the bars, the restaurants. We're looking, obviously, at the charitable gambling side. Public Safety is looking for samples of maybe illegal gambling. Revenue is obviously looking at proper tax reporting. And the liquor folks from the alcohol and gambling enforcement side are also looking at that as well. We found some interesting things when we did this. One, a surprise to the community when we got there, but it was a good indication of working together on issues related to regulatory efforts. We found one site that had cigarettes coming out of Iowa. Not good, but they're trying to avoid the tax. We've had sports boards, even though I know it comes up occasionally, but they're still illegal, and so we had found examples of that. But it's a good thing in terms of state agencies coordinating our efforts and avoiding the duplication. Cash shortages, again, $1.3 billion in gross sales, and it's all cash. But last year we reflected the lowest ever in terms of cash shortages reported by charities. And as many of you know, we've done a few things in the past few years that have really tackled that problem, that issue with the bar owners and handling the money for the charity. So I'm happy to report it's the lowest since 1985.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Robel.
Mr. Barrett, what percent is it?
Well, in terms of dollars, again, if it's $1.3 billion, we went just under the $900,000. But the I can get the percent, whatever that works out to. Now, if you look at it and say, well, geez, $900,000, that's still quite a bit. But in comparison to the volume, unfortunately, my report doesn't show that.
Okay.
Percentage.
Yes.
Was there any regulatory action taken as a result of some of those shortages?
Yes. We worked with the industry, the charitable industry, as well as Minnesota Licensed Beverage representing the bars. And this is where a couple of years ago, one of our number one initiatives was called rent reform. And we went in and we focused on what some of the problems were causing the charities as it relates to the cash management. And we found that the charities were on the hook to cover the cash shortages, even though the bartender that doesn't work for the charity works for the bar owner. And so we tightened up those regulatory efforts to really zero in on who's handling the money. And by that, we see the result here happening where it's, like I said, the lowest. Now, is there still repercussions for folks that continue to have cash shortages? Absolutely. There's still the law in the books that an organization cannot exceed by law 0.3% for cash shortages. And every month we get a report in our agency as far as those sites that are approaching that percentage when they report their monthly gross sales. So simply it's a tool we use to go, okay, where do we think we have some problem sites? And we've really focused some of the increased site visits on those sites that are having problems. And that's why I think we're seeing the decrease. We're getting out there more. Link Bingo also got started. Again, this was something that was put in motion a few years back, but we finally worked in terms of licensing and the industry to coordinate this linked
bingo
game.
Person.
But for the benefit of what it is, it's basically a number of sites around Minnesota that are conducting bingo for one time, one game during the night. They can literally tie in, link together. And what they would normally award locally at their bingo hall would simply pool the money into a combined jackpot. And it's working quite well. We did revise the rule book, making it shorter, easier to understand. But we found that as over time, the rule book got quite lengthy and very detailed. And so we found a way, working with the industry, to reduce and refine that. Ducks, cows, and golf balls, more than just a raffle ticket. What I mean by that is the last few sessions, there's been changes related to raffles, where there's an allowance for a certificate of participation. And some of you might remember the rubber duck race. It was a hot item a couple of years ago. Well, the law passed, and we found a way working with the charities
Mr. Chairman, that was the highlight of my legislative agenda one year.
And then that led to, upon board approval, other methods that we don't have to bother the legislators with. But we've seen some cases where they call a golf ball drop, you know, or some bucket elevated drops. As far as cows, we get a lot of requests every year for cow bingo. And I'll let you believe that's still not legal, okay? No animal element yet is allowed. But it's been interesting since the law was passed on how we deal with some of the creative
farmers.
What? Not even chicken pox?
And then location, again, as it relates to the smoking ban. I look to, again, a local example here, St. Paul, Rice Street, particular establishment that prior to the smoking ban was doing very well in terms of activity all around. Smoking ban came in, and their gross receipts are down upwards of 75%. You go up a half a mile, still on the same street, but in the town of Maplewood, where there's no smoking ban, and that particular bar had to expand their parking lot to accommodate. And it's just an issue that to be aware of, I think, some of the impacts, what's going on, and how it relates to on the gambling side. So looking ahead, we have a few initiatives that we're planning to hopefully come back to the committee. The organization expenses, I mentioned briefly on that. It's language. We hope that it's going to tighten up some of the restrictions on overspending when it comes to expenses. We're looking to simplify some of the education requirements for the managers. Record retention is just simply when an organization gets out of the business, the law currently requires them to retain those records, including all the leftover pull tabs, for a period of 3 years. And all we're asking is for certain situations that the board can approve the destruction of those records with the input from revenue, just to save some of the expenses there. Link Bingo, it's a technical change that allows them to no longer have a separate account just for that, because we found a way that the organizations can account for the money. And then we're giving some consideration, as you, I've gone back and forth, where we've talked of lawful gambling versus charitable. Everywhere in the statute book it says lawful. And a lot of times people will call us when the lottery's having their $1 million raffle and have questions. We have to tell them that that's the lottery and that's not us. And it might be more helpful if the word charitable was considered put back into the statutes to clarify what it is we regulate. Automation, we're on the verge of getting into a new data system for our management of all the numbers and the activity that's going on. Hopefully that'll also include an online application, online filing, which we don't have, but it's something we've been working towards. As far as the budget, we're not anticipating any increase or any changes this session for this biennial budget. We're going to continue to keep a watchful eye as it relates to the smoking ban, just the impacts, what could happen. Texas Hold'em, again, some legislation that was passed, which is not under our purview, but in those areas, the bars that have it, we're mindful of the activity that happens with that, and that's another example where we work close with public safety. And then other gambling proposals, we hear there might be another try at the sports boards, and so we're mindful of that and can bring some information to this committee as well on that. And finally, when we're still working, doing what we're doing, we're going to maintain the mission as far as the integrity and the testing of the games and making sure the charities do the best that they can. And with that, if I didn't answer or present everything, I certainly refer to our website. And now I stand for questions.
Let me ask one question really quick. You were talking about the automation that you're undertaking. Is that going to help any with the enforcement and the investigations that you're doing? I mean, it seems like when I walk into a place and see the charitable gambling, it looks like a very, very manual operation that would be very difficult to investigate and oversee properly. Is some of your automation going to address?
Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, I'm excited to say that, you know, this kind of a new system we're trying to develop. By virtue of the report that you have in front of us, I mean, tremendous manual effort to take that data from all the 1,300 organizations, put it into our system. But we use that data to extrapolate out things dealing with, like, the cash shortages or a site that might be going higher in terms of a prize payout just on the averages. It's those kind of techniques that are going to help us to quickly hit. And we have a hot list, and it's no secret to any of the charities here, but we develop what we call a hot list. Hot list being organizations or sites that are showing indications of problems. And those are the ones, you know, what gets our attention, like a revenue auditor or IRS auditor. We have a number of things that we look at, and it's that kind of sophistication that we hadn't had in the last few years that we're heading towards. So, yeah, it will help for focus on some of those problem sites.
Good. Senator Rust?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Baird, first of all, I just want to thank you for the good relationship that you've had with the legislature and in particular with Senator Vickerman and myself over the past several years in dealing with lawful gambling, charitable gambling, whatever you want to call it, issues, and I appreciate the professionalism of your office. I wondered, and this is just for information, do you have your presentation available in a hard copy form?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, yes.
I would certainly like to have a copy of it if that's available.
No, would any of the other members like a copy?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Barrett, I get people asking me, we tax those pull tabs too high. Are we in line, or are we way above everybody else? Do you know?
Well, so, Mr. Chair, Senator Rickman, that's a good question. The report that you have in front will show different percentages depending upon the organization for the value of the taxes that are paid. In Minnesota, there's what we call a combined receipts tax, and it is complicated, but it's an accelerated tax based on the amount of activity the organization has. So if you look, and I could get different sorts on this report, but we look at those organizations that are paying the highest percentage of their net receipts on taxes, it does specifically relate to the increased level of their activity. So overall, you look at the effective tax rate that's being paid on charitable gambling, and that's roughly 4%, which if you look at the lottery and they're in lieu of sales tax at 6.5%, you would say that's not bad. And yet I think you would also hear from the charities to say you know, what we're paying in taxes when we could be donating to the youth activities, the veterans, the fire relief, or if you look at those organizations that are paying a higher tax simply because they've had higher activity, that's where some of them. So I'm neutral on to say, if, you know, is it too high or not. I try to lay out, you know, a comparison and the overall rate of roughly 4% compared to a similar gambling product, the lottery. But then there's also issues related to the complexity of the tax structure that we have here in Minnesota. And that's one of the things that we're certainly open to look at in terms of a reform. Is there a way to simplify it? I believe there is, to the extent that the same dollars flow into the state or flow to the communities. That's up for you all to decide. But I think it is complicated. It causes the organizations to hire private accountants to help get through some of the tax reporting and tax computations.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up question. I noticed you had Texas Hold'em up there that you're kind of looking at. I carried that bill myself, and it was supposed to be just a friendly little game. Is it still there, or are they getting way above what we thought it was going to be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, it's still there, but it's when the law was first passed, we saw a huge increase in the activity, and I think a lot of the bar owners didn't want to be left out if this thing got to be real successful and popular. So we saw a huge increase. There's a lot of confusion, but there's also been a settling now where those sites that appear to run a good game, so to speak, maintain that following. Other sites that, for whatever reason, it didn't work for them, they're out. But there's still the concern. The key provision in this Texas Hold'em allowance is the no consideration by the player, meaning anybody could show up, but you can't require the player to buy a drink, buy a glass of water. There can be no consideration. And that, I think, lies the key to keep a lid, so to speak, on the activity. It's still a fun activity, and that's the way I think it was posed to them, to the committee, in terms of allowing it to pass. What's the harm? And it falls on the bar owner to front any kind of prize payout, whether it's a T-shirt or up to $200. It's all on their expense because it does bring in business. As it relates to the enforcement regulatory efforts, again, there was no staffing provided. It's not under our jurisdiction, but I guess I'm speaking maybe more for public safety. There was no additional staff provided public safety. But we're both agencies that are aware of the activity, and we do site inspections. We're looking to see if there's any indication of a buy-in or money that could be exchanged that would put it on the illegal side. But there are sites, a particular site over in Minneapolis. One of my staff participates in the Texas Hold'em and is a good resource. You know, how's the game playing? How's it go? What do you see? And so those areas that have followed the rules, it appears to be working well. But we've worked real close with Minnesota Licensed Beverage to make sure it doesn't get out of hand. So far it hasn't.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Now, you mentioned that the allowable expense would be reconsidered or some it might be adjusted. And I'm noticing here, and it's interesting, that the rate for various sites goes from 36 to like 70%. What would cause that large difference in how much it costs them to provide charitable gambling?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, yes, a very good perception. That's some of the things we're looking at. We see some sites that own their own building, like veterans groups, so they wouldn't be paying rent. We see other sites, for whatever reason, might have multiple organizations with multiple sites that'll hire an accountant to do some of the work. So there's different expenses that are passed on based on the organization. There's the rate of pay that somebody, a gambling manager, might be paid. There's a lot of organizations that pay their gambling manager, and there's some that don't. It's still the old days of being a volunteer. You know, everything raised goes for the good of the charity. But there's a real mix in terms of a model. At one time, we attempted to look at, should we set compensation schedules? And we didn't go there. We backed off from that simply because some organizations that might have 30 sites versus one organization that has just one site, there's some real differences of activity going on. But we're also looking at those sites that are in at the 30, and that's low. We're talking to them and basically getting their input, what works for you, and it's actually going to be a feature in one of our next newsletters to get that message out as how it works for them, versus how it might be working for their organization. But there is a variety of expenses, what an organization would pay for an audit. You know, if their gross receipts are over a certain amount, by law they're required to do a financial audit of their books, depending upon which auditor they get locally or that's known to be knowledgeable of the charitable gambling industry. Those rates are all over. We had one organization that was paying close to $9,000 for an accountant to do the annual audit. Personally, I think that's way out of line, to the extent that, you know, the services that were rendered met the needs of the organization. But that was a concern. But that's an extreme end. But it's things like that that we look at when an organization is in trouble. We ask them, what have you done to look at your expenses? And this is some of the things that it's a new focus these last 2 years for these charities, because the expenses are mounting. Sales are decreasing.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, well, we're just for the sake of time, we're going to allow one more question, and then we better move on. But
I almost forgot what it was. Let me think. Oh, what is it like? So you have some full-time managers, perhaps, like somebody would manage 30 sites. I mean, are there full-time people who do that? And what's the highest reimbursement or salary that you've seen out there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, there are full-time gambling managers. But I'd almost stop short. And I guess I don't have a specific answer I can find, because we actually did a study about 3 years ago what the rate of pay was. Not to put a limit on it, but just to get a gauge on who's being paid what. But that's something I think I need to follow up with you, just so I don't want to throw a number out there and be totally wrong. There are some that don't get paid anything, and there are some that appear to be paid quite a bit. But what we're looking at is those organizations that are at or above the expense limit, and we're asking them, what's going on? What are you paying? And we're forcing them to look at who's being paid or what some of the expenses are.
Okay, thank you.
But I'll follow up in terms of the high and the low.
Mr. Chairman, I've got one really quick question.
Yes.
Do you regulate the pull tabs in the casinos also?
Mr. Chair, Senator Day, no, we do not. That falls to the some of the oversight of public safety in terms of what they look at. I don't think they truly, I don't know where he went, but I'm not sure they look at the pull tabs per se, other than the devices. But there is differences, maybe use this opportunity, there are differences between their operation of pull tabs and the charitable. Where in the charitable side, the requirement is all the tickets for every game have to be out and available for sale. That's not the case at the tribal casinos. They might run 10,000, 15,000 ticket games. And on average, we run about 3,000.
Well, thank you. And I'm sure we could go on for much longer. But we're going to ask Clint Harris to come up and from the Minnesota State Lottery. Thanks again, Tom, for a very insightful presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. I'm Clint Harris, the executive director of the Minnesota State Lottery. In April, the Minnesota State Lottery will celebrate 17 years of raising money for the state of Minnesota. Over $5 billion in lottery tickets have been sold. Over $1.2 billion has been returned to the state. Over $3.1 billion has been awarded in prizes. Minnesota retailers have earned over $315 million. Today, I'd like to touch on some of the major points of lottery operations. You have our 2007 overview, which goes into much more detail in front of you, hopefully. What we do, Mr. Barrett has told you about what the different agencies do. We sell scratch-off and online lottery tickets. This is not an easy job. We sell in a highly competitive and rapidly changing marketplace. We have been described as a business in government wrapping. Competition is more than just other gaming. It's every other impulse item sold at a store. We have to compete for shelf space and visibility. No retailer has to sell a lottery ticket. No customer has to buy one. Our survey shows that in terms of participation, the lottery is the game of choice in Minnesota. Last year, 60% more Minnesotan adults bought a lottery ticket than went to a casino, and more than twice as many bought a lottery ticket than bought a pull tab.
It cost me $38 when I was all done.
But in terms of dollars wagered, we are far from the largest. We don't know how much is wagered at casinos, but one outside estimate placed their after-prize revenue at around $1.4 billion, suggesting wagering in excess of $10 billion a year. This same estimate places Minnesota's tribal casino industry as the fifth largest in the country, following California, Connecticut, Arizona, and Oklahoma. The illegal gambling number is an estimate from the Department of Public Safety. We offer two basic types of games, scratch tickets and online tickets. Last year, we introduced 42 new scratch games. Each retailer will have between 60 and 20 games on sale at any one time. Different players have different preferences for game themes, play styles, top prizes, prices, and they like new games as well. Online games have a longer shelf life. Tickets are generated by a computer terminal at the retailer that is connected to a central system. Powerball is the best known online game, but not the only one. Both types of games have security that is extensive and impressive, as documented by the legislative auditor.
And I know it's Sherman Bacon. Hardly got doorstop.
Fiscal year 06 was our best sales year ever. We are unlikely to match that level in fiscal year 07. Fiscal year 06 saw record Powerball jackpots of $340 million in October of that year and $365 million in February. The highest jackpot so far in fiscal year 07 has been $204
million.
That was earlier this year. Sales for the $365 million draw were $6 million. For the $204 million drawing, they were not quite $2 million. That kind of gives you an idea of the magnitude of sales depending on the size of the jackpot. Sales are difficult to project depending on things like gas prices, the state of the economy, and particularly the random nature of jackpots.
Which would be almost 50% or a little less.
Lottery returns to the state. Fiscal year 06 was our third straight record year for the money the lottery provided the state. Again, we're unlikely to match that total in fiscal year 07 because of last year's record Powerball jackpots. But we do expect to continue the overall pattern of slow, steady growth we began in 2004. Here's how the lottery dollars divided. The single biggest item is prizes. Without adequate prizes, no one would play. Finding the level that maximizes revenues to the state is always a challenge. Last year, operating costs were 5% of revenue. Retailers earn about 6 cents on every dollar of tickets they sell. The lottery contributes to the state program in several ways. Net proceeds are what a business would call profits. The Constitution guarantees that 40% of the proceeds will go to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund through the year 2024. The rest now goes to the general fund, though that is the discretion of that's at the discretion of the legislature. Players have a year to claim prizes, and any that are not claimed after that time goes to the general fund. In fiscal year 06, we turned over $7 million to the general fund. Just to give you an example, we actually have a $1.5 million Go for Five winning ticket that was sold on January 17th of last year. And so we issued a press release to try to, one more time, to try to remind players to look for tickets that were sold on that date to see if we can award that $1.5 million prize.
Senator Ruff?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Harris, have we not looked at dividing up the unclaimed prize money to also go to the Environmental Trust Fund as well? I'm trying to remember that. You just said it goes 100% to the general fund, correct?
Yes, I believe that's the current.
Have we not had discussions about sending those dollars with a 60-40 split before, too, or am I thinking of something else? Am I recalling that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, for the record, Don Feeney, Research Director, Minnesota State Lottery. The unclaimed prize money has been divided several different ways in the past, and it's been considered to be divided many more ways in the past. And I believe it, very briefly, if I remember correctly, it was divided 60-40. That was changed several sessions ago.
Mr. Chairman, what we may want to revisit that. I think what, as I'm trying to remember, we sent it all to the general fund, particularly in 2003 when we had our $4 billion deficit. But we may want to rethink that policy when we're not in such dire straits, and the Environmental Trust Fund, I think, could use that 40%.
Thank you, Senator Rust.
We might come back to that
Yes. Some
other time.
There is a 6.5% in lieu of sales tax, as Mr. Barrett indicated. A lottery disposition of this is up to the legislature. It is currently split between the Game and Fish Fund, the General Fund, and the Natural Resources Fund, which goes for state, metro, and local parks and trails in the state's three zoos. Each biennium, the legislature makes an appropriation from the lottery prize fund to finance the Department of Human Services compulsive gambling program. This appropriation was $3.9 million for the current biennium. It is one of the best-funded programs in the country. The lottery is the sole source of funding for this program. Every prize winner over 600 is checked for debts owed to state, including back taxes and child support. The lottery has collected over $2 million this way over the last 17 years. Prizes are subject to federal and state income taxes. In fiscal year 6, more than $2 million was withheld for Minnesota state income tax alone. Lottery governance. The lottery was authorized by voters in 1988, the 1988 election. It's operated by the director, who is appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate. The director serves at the pleasure of the governor. The governor and legislature reviewed the budget and established spending limits for the lottery. Unlike other agencies, we do not receive a line item appropriation. Instead, the legislature establishes that spending limit for us. The limit covers administrative costs such as personnel, advertising, data processing. It does not cover the cost of tickets, prizes, or retailer commissions. As you can see, we are down to 145 permanent employees, down from 25% from 2000. We're down to 4 regional offices. We had 6 at one time, and our operating budget for 07 is capped at $27.4 million. This spending limit of $27.4 million, again, is for fiscal year 07. We're predicting that our actual operating expenses will come in at around $26.2 million for this current fiscal year. Cuts in operating expenses have come from staff costs, advertising, promotion, office space reductions, as I indicated. We will continue to invest when it leads to increased revenues. For example, we've been investing in new scratch ticket dispensers, vending machines, and the recent raffle game that we launched for the first time.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Harris, what happens to the $1.2 million then? Is that just revert to the general fund, or is it you get a carry forward on that if you come in under your spending cap?
It's just nothing. That $1.2 million wouldn't exist because we generate our own revenue. Mr. Chairman, sorry.
Yes.
No, it's under duress. There isn't $27.2 million set
there,
aside for
I
us
see.
To use.
It's, you can it's, spend up to that. And
yeah, we can spend
me,
up
Chairman,
to that.
And then when you spend
less, there's more money for the state.
And has the spending cap been going down or staying steady, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Harris?
It's been.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I don't remember the percentages, but I believe there was a slight increase for fiscal 06 from fiscal 05, basically so we're sure we can cover whatever is negotiated for personnel costs in the union contracts.
Thank you.
New initiatives, as I mentioned, I talked a little bit about the raffle game. We just conducted a drawing for our first raffle game on New Year's Day. We had guaranteed 2 $1 million prizes as well as 108 other prizes. We sold all 500,000 tickets in just 8 weeks, and it was a very successful game for us. Players, we had the most calls from players about any game that we've ever offered. It's a short-term game. We're looking to decide whether we will do it again in the future. Lucky Minnesota is a sort of a VIP club, or a very important player club, if you will, that's based on internet-based. It's a way to keep touch with our players. Players can sign up to receive winning numbers and other information via email. It's a special website. It allows players who are members to enter promotional drawings and contests. We started this players club in May of 2006, and we currently have 12,260 active members who are looking at it and having fun and so on. I should also add, this is not unique. A lot of lotteries have started this. We've just been a little slow in getting ours up there. Our mission. In 2004, the lottery created its first ever strategic plan. This past summer, the staff reviewed and revised the plan. You have the complete plan in your handouts. And in the interest of time, I won't go into all the details of the plan today. But I encourage you to review it and let us know if you have any questions. I do want to share our mission statement, however. The lottery offers fun, innovative, and secure games that create excitement, reflect Minnesota values, and maximize contributions to the state. So with that, our website, there's a wealth of information on our webpage, which is the address is right there on the screen. Please feel free to contact me or my staff at any time. And we, of course, would welcome you to collectively or individually to tour our offices in Roseville if you have time. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Entertain questions.
Mr. Feeney, Mr. Harris, any questions of them? Thank you. We will move on in the agenda then. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the presentation, and we'll ask Richard Krueger, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, to come and give us a preview of what he's got coming up. There's a handout.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, members of the committee, what's your pleasure, Mr. Chairman, with regard to time? Did you want to adjourn at 5:30?
We would like to adjourn at 5:30.
Okay. I will try to summarize the presentation that I have prepared. At the end of it, I would like to give the committee a chronology of the new racetrack that we licensed to be opened in Columbus Township, and then to give you an update of the status of Canterbury Park at the present time. Mr. Chairman, I'm Dick Krueger, the Executive Director of the Racing Commission. I'll give you a brief overview of the organization and operation of the commission. Page one of the handout cites Minnesota Statutes Chapter 240.03, which details the powers and the duties that the legislature has given to the commission. The second page of the handout details the primary responsibilities that the commission has imposed upon itself by rule to accomplish the duties and powers that have been defined by the legislature. One of those is licensure. The legislature has established four different types of licenses. A Class A license is a license to own a pari-mutuel racetrack. A Class B license is a license to run a pari-mutuel race meet at a Class A facility. Since 1985, we have had one, and in January of 2005, the commission did issue a second Class A and a B license to the North Metro Harness Initiative up in Anoka County. Page four of the handout details the occupational licenses that the commission issues. Those are licenses to folks that work at, own horses, or provide some sort of a service at the racetrack. All of those people go through a very detailed application process and a background investigation, including fingerprinting of individuals who are in Minnesota for the first time, or re-fingerprinting every 5 years as required by the legislature. Last year, we issued just over 4,100 licenses. Just over half of those were to Minnesota residents, and the other licenses were issued to folks from 43 other states, as well as Canada, Mexico, and England. The legislature has also authorized the issuance of Class D licenses, which are licenses to county agricultural associations or county fairs that desire to race paramutually. Usually that's standard bred or harness racing, to race paramutually during their county fair event. We have had one county that has done that, the Traverse County Fair in Wheaton, Minnesota, and they raced from 1994 to 2001. Just briefly on the commission staff and budget, our full-time equivalence is 8.3 positions. That includes myself, a newly hired deputy director, a licensing and paramutual coordinator, two investigators. One of the investigators, by the way, is dedicated for the card club oversight, which we were cited in the legislative auditor's evaluation that was released at the end of 2004, in which they said we did not have enough regulatory staff for the card club. So we did add that position during this current biennium. And then during a live meet, we do add other positions. They're professional technical contract individuals, three stewards, three veterinarians, and then we do also hire two seasonal veterinary assistants. Our fiscal 6 appropriated general fund revenues. In 2003, the legislature changed the way we're funded from general fund to dedicated receipts by increasing the license fees for our racetracks. And our 2006 expenditures total $462,000. And our budgeted expenditures for 2007 is anticipated to be $670,000. On pages 5 and 6 of the handout, there's a summary of the handle for Canterbury Park that goes back to 1985. In prior testimony to the legislature, I've always indicated that, you know, in 2002, 2003, 2004, the handle was modestly increasing, and it's what happens at Canterbury Park that the state's horsemen and women make their decisions as to the investment they want to make in their bloodstock. But as you can see from the charts that we have there, that the handle has been declining in 05 and 06. The handle is actually down about 8.5% just this last year versus 2004. That also causes a decrease in our general fund paramutual tax collections. Those also declined just over 8% from $247,000 in fiscal 5 to $221,000 in fiscal 6. Just briefly, going over the primary duties, staff duties during live racing, that would be the stewards and our veterinary staff. By law, we have to have three stewards on the grounds, two of which have to be employees or contractors of the commission. One of those two has to be the chief steward. Since 1990, the commission has been contracting for all three of the stewards, and the stewards, by the way, are reimbursed. The cost of the stewards are reimbursed to us by the racetracks. The stewards are actually the referees of the running of a race. They have access to video technology while a race is being run. If anything were to happen during during the running of a race, they have replay capability. They can go slow motion, super slow motion, whatever. There's telephones in the winner's circle where they do talk to the jockeys if there is an incident that happened during the running of the race. And should they make a disqualification, that decision is final and cannot be appealed by the trainer or the horse owner. The legislature has also given the stewards judicial powers. They act as a board of judges. For any infractions of rules, they get a report from either our investigative staff or the Canterbury staff, and they conduct hearings. They take sworn testimony. They issue findings of fact, conclusions, and an order. And the legislature has given them authority to fine individuals up to $2,000 or to suspend them up to 90 days. The other major program of the commission during live racing is the veterinary program, and here we get into as much into animal husbandry as we do the actual pari-mutuel gambling and the money that's going over the windows. There's a medical record is created for every horse that comes on the grounds. Just under 1,500 records were created last year and maintained by the veterinary staff. Those records are updated each time a horse is examined, whether prior to a race or following a race, should an injury have occurred. The vets also conduct pre-race exams. I don't know the exact number of states that do this, but we're one of the few states that do pre-race exams, where each horse that's racing that day is examined by, we usually have two of the vets out on morning rounds, and they look at every horse that's going to be racing that day, and in some instances they will scratch a horse from the race if it appears that it's not going to give its full performance. Last summer, the vets conducted just under 5,600 of those pre-race exams. Each horse is observed further on race day in the paddock when they're in the walking ring prior to the race. The vets accompany the horse to the racetrack and observe the horse in the post parade. If a horse is scratched for any reason, whether because of the morning exam, or if it comes back after a race a little gimpy and it goes on the vet's list, that horse cannot race again until it has performed a workout under the visual supervision of our veterinarians. And that's all done not only for the safety of the horse, but also for the betting public, that they know that when they put $10 on a horse that they're going to get the optimum performance from that horse. We have a medical testing program, and in that at least two horses in every race are tested. One of those two horses has to be the winner. There are occasions when the stewards may special a horse because it didn't perform up to expectations. After the race, our test barn technicians accompany the horse from the winner's circle to the test barn, where one of our veterinarians does draw blood after the collection of urine. All of those samples are then sealed under the witnessing of a representative of the trainer or the owner, and the samples are sent to our testing lab in Truesdale Testing Lab in Tustin, California. And again, the cost of that program is reimbursed to us by the racetrack. We also administer the Breeders' Fund program. On page 7, it displays all the breeds and the early registrations by breed going back to 1985. This was a program that was set up by the legislature. It's a 1% tax on the handle that is paid to the commission. We take about $32,000 every year to administer the program. After that, about 20% is set aside for equine research and related education that goes to the University of Minnesota. And then there's a variety of other programs the legislature has allowed us to use that money for, things like substance abuse programs and other related education on commission activities. After those have been deducted, the balance of the money goes to the owners and breeders of racehorses in Minnesota, and we're expecting that to be about $1.2 million for each year of the current biennium. The legislature in the 99 session passed a bill authorizing a Class A licensee to operate card clubs. After that session in 99, or after the live meet in 99, Canterbury began composing their plan of operation. They submitted it to us. We worked with them. We had many meetings with them, representatives from the Shakopee Police Department, the agents from the Alcohol Gambling Enforcement Division, and presented that plan to the commission at their January meeting in 2000. And I just mentioned that, you know, going back to 99, because we will use that same protocol in reviewing and approving the plan of operation for the new racetrack up in Columbus Township. They have submitted a plan of operation to us. We're in the process of reviewing it. We'll probably get more into it after the live meet at Canterbury, but we do intend to use the same protocol with the Anoka County Sheriff's Office as opposed to the Shakopee PD. As I mentioned, the commission approved the plan at its meeting in January of 2000, and the essential details of that plan included overall policies for security, surveillance, internal controls, the games to be played, hours of operation, which is 24/7, collection rake amounts, dealer and dealeen procedures to be followed, patron and employee and licensee conduct in the card room. And page 8 of the handout displays the rake and the purse amount set aside since 2000. Total rake for 2006 was $29.5 million. Of that, $4.5 million by statute is set aside for purses, and of the $4.5 million, $453,000 was paid to the Racing Commission for purse supplements for Minnesota bred restricted races. Those are races that are just limited to horses that are bred in the state of Minnesota. And the intent of the card club legislation is stipulated in the law. It was the intent of the legislature to improve the horse racing industry by improving purses. And that's exactly what the card club has done. It has added about $17 million to the purse structure at Canterbury since the card club opened in 2000. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll go on to those other two items I briefly mentioned at the beginning. That's a chronology of the licensing issue that we went through with North Metro Harness Initiative. I don't have a handout for you on this. Southwest Casino and Hotel Corporation is the Minnesota partner in that racetrack, and they filed an application with us on December 23rd of 2003. And throughout 2004, we did our analysis and evaluation of the application. The chair of the Racing Commission then and still is Darcy Heitzman. She appointed an ad hoc application review committee. That committee met 9 times during the summer and fall of 2004. We contracted with an outside accounting firm to do the financial review and evaluation. All of this is paid by the applicant under the investigation fee that we're authorized to charge. And we did have two public hearings. By statute, we're required to have a public hearing in the community where the track is to be located. And we did, I recall, we held that hearing in Columbus City Hall, or Columbus Township Hall at the time, in April of 2004. We did have a second hearing in Shakopee at the petition of the horsemen that race at Canterbury. The commission approved both the A and the B licenses at its January 2005 meeting, roughly 14 months after we had received the application. We were then sued by an organization called the Columbus Concerned Citizens. They filed a commission on 2 occasions. One was for violating the open meeting law, and the other one was questioning the license approval process. And we did prevail in the Court of Appeals on both of those matters. That obviously held up progress on the project for North Metro. But they have finally cleared the second to the last hurdle of their project, and that's the archaeological work that they discovered had to be done once they started to move some ground on the facility. They did get approval of their plan of mitigation from the Corps of Engineers early in December. And their last hurdle was they presented to the commission at their last meeting a preliminary financing agreement, because they're going to have to borrow $40 million. To finance this project. And that funding organization is called Black Diamond Commercial Finance, LLC, which provides financing to middle market companies in a variety of industries throughout U.S., Canada, and Europe, and they have offices in Greenwich, Connecticut, and Lake Forest, Illinois, and one in London, and we're currently in the process. We're working with the Alcohol Gambling Enforcement Division to do the background investigation of that organization. I've reviewed some of the material that they have provided, and this will be one of their smaller financing arrangements, at least that I've seen. January 18th of this month, a week from tomorrow, they're scheduling a groundbreaking ceremony down in city of Columbus, and they have told the commission they plan to race their first harness meet. This is a track that has to be dedicated. Since it's the second track in the seven-county metro area, it has to be harness racing. And they're planning now to run a 50-day meet in the spring of 2008. They have, at the monthly meetings of the commission, we get an update from them, and they have indicated to the commission their legislative program will be what it was the last 2 years, which is to have all breeds simulcasting. Currently, the statute stipulates that you can only simulcast the breed that you race, but they said they'd have a bill in to allow all breed simulcasting. Current law requires them to race 50 days before they can open the card club. They want to get approval to open the card club after the commission has assigned 50 days of live racing, and they have to race 50 days to maintain the Class A license. Statute indicates if they don't, the commission must revoke their license. And then briefly, if I could just give you an update of Canterbury Park, again referring to pages 5 and 6 of the handout where I had indicated the handle has been declining for the last 2 years. It's down at the end of 06, the handle was down about 8.5% since 2004. That affects not only our general fund revenue collections, but it also affects the revenues to Canterbury Park. And in that regard, management of Canterbury has issued a letter to their employees asking them that they take voluntary time off or voluntarily take reduced hours so that they can begin to control some of their expenditures under this case of reduced revenues. You know, if that doesn't work, then they're talking about layoffs, job elimination, and things like that. You know, it remains to be seen how that's going to work out. Hopefully, over the next quarter or two quarters, that problem will go away for Canterbury and the revenues will stay up. But I just felt compelled to let the committee know what was going on out there. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my remarks. And
thanks. I have one quick question. The authority to open the cards prior to the 50-day racing operation, is your commission taking a position on that application, that request?
No.
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 Just informing us that
need legislation.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
No. They may ask the commission. The commission's meeting twice a month. They may come in and ask the commission to take a public position on that. And, you know, my caution will be that, you know, before you do, make sure you check with the governor to see how he wants you to stand on that issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Roebling.
I know in the past that, well, your offices are located at Canterbury, right?
That's correct.
So if there's another track in the area, will you co-locate or How will you manage your office situation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, by statute, the racetracks have to provide us, at no cost, adequate office space. So in their drawings of the grandstand, they have a suite of offices for the Racing Commission staff. As far as our budget goes, this is a heads up for Senator Betzold. We have submitted an initiative to the Department of Finance to upgrade our information technology, which we hope, well, we don't hope, we're going to tie in to the databases that we're going to need at the new racetrack, meaning the Breeders' Fund and the Parimutuel Auditing System, whereby I want, you know, we've got antiquated, we were written up in the OLA report back in 2004 for not having upgraded our information technology, and it's really in bad shape. So we've put together an initiative to finance, and I'll know on the 23rd whether they've supported that or not. I think they will. It won't require any new money. We've collected more money than what the legislature appropriated 2 years ago, and we didn't spend all of the appropriations. So putting all that together, we've come up with it's about a $360,000 initiative for this year, but it will allow us to tie the two tracks together from a data processing standpoint, and I think it'll save us from having to hire another paramutual auditor, because I want to be able to download the information directly from the TOTE systems to our system so that we don't have to go through the data entry of all that data into not only the paramutual system but also our breeders fund system to track the dollars. So, but that's kind of a long answer to your question, Senator Roebling, but you led me down another path there.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Krueger? Seeing none, I will thank you, Mr. Krueger, for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. And we'll adjourn.